So how do we get exploitation out of all this? Here is the basic trick, you know, the brilliant idea that Marx had. The labor theory of value was not something that Marx invented. Labor theory of value was more or less the broadly accepted way of talking about the value of things in the middle of the 19th century. It's not that everybody said it exactly the same way, but this was not Marx's insight. The basic idea that the value of things on a market are determined by the amount of labor time embodied in them was a pretty much accepted idea in classical economics. What Marx, however, observed was the following. There's one particular kind of commodity on the market which is different from all other commodities with respect to the question of the labor time it takes to produce, and in which the meaning of the labor time it takes to produce needs to be thought about a bit. And that commodity is labor power. Now, workers sell something on the market. Right? Workers sell to capitalists their capacity to work. That's called labor power. The expression labor power in Spanish, is it poder or is it force?
Force.
So in English, the term labor force means the total population of people laboring. It doesn't mean the capacity to work. In Spanish, labor force is the term for the, in English is labor power. When you get hired by a capitalist, what the capitalist gets is your ability to work. The capitalist doesn't actually buy your labor. He buys the ability to direct your labor, your laboring activity. And what's essentially being purchased, Marx argued, is labor power, this capacity to work. Well, if we have a labor theory of value, then labor power, like every other commodity, has a value. It not only produces value when it's used, it has a value. And the value of all commodities is simply the cost of producing it. Well, what is the cost of producing labor power? It's all the food, clothing, shelter, and other costs it takes to reproduce the worker from day to day. It takes a certain amount of food for a worker to be able to show up to work from day to day. So let's just be real simple. Let us suppose that the only cost of producing labor power is a loaf of bread. Now, let's just make it simple. A loaf of bread, that's all it takes. You get a loaf of bread every day, and then you can show up for work the next day. It takes a loaf of bread. That would then mean that the value of labor power would be one loaf of bread. But, of course, the loaf of bread itself has a value, which depends upon how much time it takes to produce the loaf of bread. Let's suppose, just to be simple-minded, that a loaf of bread embodies 4 hours of abstract, socially necessary labor time. What that means, then, is if it takes one loaf of bread to produce a worker for one day, to produce the labor power of a worker, the capacity to work for one day, and the loaf of bread takes 4 hours to produce, the value of labor power is 4 hours of labor time. Now, here's then the trick that capitalism creates. When the capitalist goes on the labor market to hire a worker, what the capitalist says is, if you come and work for me for a day, 8 hours, I will give you the value of your labor power. That is, I'll give you a loaf of bread. Like every other commodity, it is sold at its value. Exchanged on the competitive labor, on the competitive market, and its value will equal its cost of production. So the capitalist gives the worker a loaf of bread, and the worker agrees to work for the capitalist for 8 hours. Now, if the capitalist gave the worker a loaf of bread and the worker only agreed to work for 4 hours, and the capitalist agreed to that, what would be the result? Well, the worker would have added 4 hours worth of labor to the products of the capitalist and would have been paid 4 hours of labor equivalent. equivalent in the form of a loaf of bread, and there'd be nothing left over. The value of what the worker produced would be exactly the same as the value of the commodity which the worker sold to the capitalist. And there'd be nothing left over. So the capitalist would have gained no profits from the employment of that labor power. What, of course, the capitalist is able to do is to tell a worker, no, I'm not going to hire you for only 4 hours. If you want to work for me, you have to work for 8 hours. Why do workers accept that bargain? You know, in one sense, it doesn't seem like a good deal. I mean, if you're going to produce 8 hours worth of value, you should get paid 8 hours worth of value in your own consumption. But why do they accept the deal? The reason they accept the deal is because of power. It's a reflection of the fact that the worker's exit option is starvation. And the capitalist's refusal to hire one worker is just to refuse that worker and there's other workers available. So long as you have workers whose only option is starvation, you know, in the very simplified abstract example, it gets more complicated in real world examples, then capitalists have a huge power advantage in negotiating these deals with workers. Now that doesn't mean that the capitalists have unlimited power. They can say, you're going to work for 8 hours. They can't say necessarily, you're going to work for 18 hours. So there are constraints, and the constraints are caused by all sorts of things, including the collective power of workers, sometimes even the individual power of workers. But roughly speaking, workers have a much worse exit option than capitalists, and the power differential is cashed out in the form of workers having to work for more hours than the value they produce. Yeah.
Did Marx go as far to claim as something like unemployment then is necessary in order for capitalist society to work, or say, I don't know, the lack of health care is necessary for...
Well, he certainly believed that unemployment was necessary, that if you had permanently tight labor markets, that is, workers didn't have to fear being fired, that wages would rise to the point where it would put a huge squeeze on profits, potentially eliminating them, you know, but at least the tendency would be to have that particular form of threat to capitalist profits called the profit squeeze. And in some times and places, that has indeed been a problem for capitalists, that unemployment was too low and wages rose accordingly. The reason why wages rise when labor markets are low is basically because capitalists poach each other's workers. You know, the basic problem is that the most productive capitalists will suddenly find that they can't hire workers, there aren't any workers out there to hire. And therefore, they're going to try to raid the workers of other firms. And the way you lure workers away is by offering them higher wages. So capitalists bid up wages, which individually makes sense for each capitalist, but has the effect in the long term of lowering the overall rate of profit by shifting this balance between the value of labor power and the total amount of time that workers work. Now, so in my little stylized example, because of the power difference between capitalists and workers, and that's fundamental here, is that this is rooted in power, workers have no choice but to work more hours than they contribute, than is embodied in their wages, in the form of the commodities which they consume with their wages. In the example I gave, they work 8 hours a day, but they only consume the equivalent of 4 hours in the one loaf of bread. This is very different from the way exploitation works in feudalism. You know, in the classical stylized case of feudalism, the peasant works on the family plot or the community plot for 4 or 5 days a week and works for the feudal lord for 2 days a week. The feudal lord enforces that in the form of the sheriff of Nottingham, you know, going out and reminding the peasants that they have to work 2 days a week on the lands owned by the lord. The lord appropriates all of the crops on the lord's land, and the peasants appropriate all of the crops on their land. And there's a very clear division between how much of the time a peasant is working for
his or her own needs and how much of the time they're working for the surplus that's consumed by the few awards. In the capitalist case, it's much less clear, it's less transparent. One could imagine a capitalist firm that would work on the principle, the first 4 hours of the day, everything you produce is yours, you can take home with you, and the next 4 hours of the day, everything you produce is mine. You could divide up the day that way. One would expect that the amount of effort put in the first part of the day would be considerably higher than the second part of the day under those conditions, which, by the way, was a problem in feudalism as well. Peasants worked much more diligently and energetically in the part of the week they were doing their own crops than in the part of the week they were doing the lord's crops. So, there was a supervision problem there as well. But exploitation is less transparent in capitalism. That's one of the charms of capitalism, one of the things that makes it a more stable kind of social order. Workers get paid for every hour they work. They get $10 an hour, and they work 40 hours, and they get a paycheck for $400. It looks like they've been paid for the entire work that they performed. But in terms of the abstract labor time, the amount of labor value that they can command in the market for their $10 an hour ends up being, in my example, half of the total value which they contributed to production. In Marx's account, then, the difference between the total amount of labor performed per day and the value of labor embodied in the wage, that difference is the source of profits for capitalists. That difference is called surplus value. In the formal equations that represent this process in Marxist political economy, the way it's described, the terms that are used are L equals the length of the working day, and L is divided into two components. L can be labor time too. Think of it as total labor time. It's divided into two components. V, which is also defined as variable capital, just means the value of labor power, basically. The amount of capital that's devoted to paying the labor force. And S is the surplus. So S is surplus value, value above and beyond needed to reproduce workers, or pay the workers. And V is the value of labor power. So L equals V plus S. The total value of all commodities produced contains one other component. That's almost dead labor, labor performed in the production of the inputs and means of production. And that's called C in the standard expressions for this. C stands for constant capital. We don't have to worry about why it's constant versus variable. I mean, there's many other terms that could have been used for historically specific reasons in the way these problems were initially framed. That was the language that was used. We don't need to get into that. The total value of production, then, is C plus B plus S. Those are the three components. Constant capital plus L, the amount of labor performed, which is itself composed of V, the value of labor power, and S, surplus value. And the ratio then of S over V is called the rate of exploitation. In a way, it would be slightly more natural perhaps to call the rate of exploitation S over L, that is, the amount of surplus divided by the total amount of labor performed. You know, that could have been defined as the rate of exploitation as well. In a sense, it has a more intuitive meaning. It just says how much of your labor time is being exploited. But the convention, for various mathematical reasons, because of how this concept gets used in various equations, S over V is the standard way of defining what's called the rate of exploitation. Now, if once you adopt this framework, there's all sorts of interesting things that you can fiddle around with. If you have a given rate of exploitation, S over V, you can easily see that there's two ways in which you could increase the rate of exploitation. Two different ways. One is you could make people work longer. Right? If we could, if it still takes one loaf of bread to keep somebody alive and healthy from one day to the next, and you can increase the amount of work from 8 hours a day to 10 hours a day, the rate of exploitation goes up because you've increased S. V remains the same, and S goes up. Another way you could increase the rate of exploitation is if you could figure out a way of making bread really, really cheaply. If instead of bread taking 4 hours to produce, it takes 2 hours to produce. You know, so you figure out a way of automating bread production so that now you still pay the worker one loaf of bread a day, but it takes a half the amount of time to produce that loaf of bread. Then S over V, the ratio goes up, but it goes up because the denominator goes down. The first of those ways of increasing exploitation is called absolute surplus value. It's absolute exploitation. You increase exploitation by increasing the intensity of exploitation. How? And the length of the working day is the standard way of thinking about that. You could, incidentally, this gets more complicated, also factor in the intensity of labor. You know, if you can get people to work much, much harder, that's like having them work longer. If you can lower V by improving the productivity of production of the commodities workers consume, that's called relative surplus value. You've increased the relative rate of exploitation by lowering the value of labor power. Now, historically, Marx and other Marxists have argued, in the course of the early course of capitalist development, the rate of exploitation went up primarily by lengthening the working day, by increasing the amount of time workers spent in production, therefore increasing S. There's some very interesting work about the early Industrial Revolution and the shift from cottage industry to factories. There's a wonderful paper from the 70s, very famous paper called What Do Bosses Do? By Stephen Marsden. But many other studies have made the same argument. In which basically, the problem in cottage industry, you'd have a weaver who would get inputs from a capitalist and produce cloth, which the capitalist would take, and the weaver would get paid a piece rate or on some formula for how much work was done. There were lots of problems with cottage industry, but one of them was that it was very hard to get workers to work as hard as the capitalist wanted them to. It was very hard to lengthen the length of the working day. It also turned out to be very hard to prevent theft, because weavers could steal threads and then do weaving on the side for themselves. It was also hard for the capitalists to prevent weavers getting supplies to use those looms on their own outside of the supervision of the capitalist group. There's all sorts of problems. So they, in the early Industrial Revolution, with no change in technology at all, the looms that were previously in cottages were simply brought into a big warehouse with foremen to supervise them. And that enabled the length of the working day to be extended with no improvements in productivity whatsoever, just an increase of exploitation. It was only after that, once the looms were all brought into a big place altogether, that it became economically rational to then try to figure out ways of improving the technology through the use of power-driven looms. So the power-driven looms, which improved productivity fantastically, came after a creation of large factories with non-power-driven looms, and that was driven strictly by the needs of exploitation, the need to control the effort levels of workers. So the social process sets the stage for the technological change, as opposed to a vision of the Industrial Revolution where it's technological breakthroughs that are, in the first instance, the driving force of the change. Well, those are two ways that you can increase exploitation. In the early Industrial Revolution, it was all increasing the absolute
degrading exploitation, lengthening the working days to inhuman levels. Eventually, you reach a limit. You know, you can only do that for so long. The quality of work goes down. There's all sorts of reasons why, both because of resistance from workers, but also for technical reasons why ever-increasing absolute surplus value turns out to be counterproductive. Subsequently, exploitation became primarily determined by the efficiencies of production of the cost of labor power. Now, this is a reason why, by the way, it's not at all obvious to know whether workers in El Salvador or in the United States can answer the question, who is more exploited in Marx's terms, in value terms. We know who lives better lives, who suffer more. But if the rate of productivity of the means of production and of the commodities that workers consume is much, much higher in one place than another, it can be the case that the workers can both have a higher standard of living and be more exploited. Both can be true. Because the value of their labor power is not determined by the use value of their labor power, the use value of the commodities, but by what it costs to produce them. And the higher labor productivity, you know, in all sorts of ways in the developed capitalist world, could mean that the rate of exploitation is as high or higher than it is in less developed parts of the world, even though, of course, the conditions of life are much worse. All right, so that's the Marxian concept of exploitation expressed in terms of the labor theory of value. And you see why this creates a really powerful framework for thinking about the nature of the relationship between workers and capitalists. Right? So the profits of capitalists come from the extraction of surplus from workers. And that extraction depends upon the amount of effort and time workers spend in production. It therefore becomes crucial for capitalists to control the exit options of workers. Unemployment is a good thing from the capitalist point of view. You hear contemporary economists saying that as well. The unemployment rate is getting too low. Labor markets are getting too tight. And what does that mean? It means that it's harder to extract effort and surplus from workers. Labor theory of value does provide a way of talking about this. It's, however, also problematic in various ways. And as I will argue probably more on Monday than now, I don't think you need the labor theory of value to understand the nature of the antagonism between capitalists and workers around the performance of labor effort. The labor theory of value is one way of creating a convenient accounting system so you can measure. But you don't need it in order to understand the basic idea, and you don't need the labor theory of value as a general account of exchange value in order to understand why the interests of workers and capitalists are antagonistic. So let me now just briefly talk about some of the objections to the labor theory of value. Let me just say one other thing first. The fact that you can discuss exploitation without the labor theory of value doesn't mean that's not a proof that the labor theory of value is wrong. It just may mean that the same idea can be expressed in more than one way. The only reason one might want to abandon the labor theory of value is, therefore, not simply that it's not necessary, but there may be objections to it which make it a liability, not simply an unnecessary element of a theory. So what are the central objections to the labor theory of value? Well, I'll give you what I consider the core issue here. Marx doesn't provide a sustained defense of the labor theory of value anywhere. He takes it more or less for granted. He defends his use of the labor theory of value. But he doesn't ever provide a systematic account for why he indeed believes it is the case that the socially necessary abstract labor time embodied in commodities is the actual determinant of the value of those commodities, and thus the regulator of the prices of production and ultimately of the exchange of commodities. That labor is the only source of value. The one place where Marx discusses this, he gives an argument which is not, in fact, I think, a sound argument. So here's the argument. Here's Marx's standard, or simple argument for why labor time is the source of value. That's the claim that has to be defended. Labor time is the source of value in commodities. We observe that two commodities exchange at regular, predictable rates, but they're qualitatively different. In order to exchange at a well-defined and predictable rate, he argues, they must have something in common that's quantitative, that regulates the quantities, the quantitative aspect of their exchange. In order for two qualitatively different things to exchange at determinate, predictable, systematic, quantitative rates, they must have something quantitatively in common. There must be something quantitatively the same about a pair of shoes and 20 apples in order for that to be the stable equilibrium exchange rate between these two kinds of commodities. And then Marx says, and this is where I think he is not correct, the only thing they have in common is that they are products of labor. Now, it is true that they do have in common that they are products of labor, but it isn't the only thing they have in common. Therefore, it can't be a defense of labor being the source of value that labor is the only thing that they have in common, because it's not in fact true that it's the only thing they have in common, quantitatively. There's many other things that they have in common quantitatively that could function just as well as labor as what's called the value numeraire. That expression, the value numeraire, just means the metric by which you impute an underlying quantitative value to different commodities. Some economists have proposed what they sarcastically call the peanut theory of value. In an interdependent economy in which a lot of peanut butter is consumed, you can show that every commodity embodies a certain number of peanuts, directly or indirectly. Because the workers who produce the commodities consume peanuts. The workers who produce the lumber that goes into the chairs consume peanuts, even if the carpenter didn't consume any peanuts. And you could measure the peanut value of every commodity in terms of the number of peanuts embodied, the abstract peanuts embodied. Less fancifully, you could have a caloric theory of value. That is, you could say every commodity embodies a certain number of kilowatt hours of energy. Some of it expended by human beings and their muscles, some of it expended by turbines in wind turbines, some of it expended by internal combustion engines. You could calculate the total amount of energy in terms of kilowatt hours embodied in every commodity, and you'd have an energy theory of value. And you could say, you could then calculate the total amount of energy in 20 apples and the total amount of energy in a pair of shoes and see how that regulates their exchange to the extent to which it does. Now, it turns out that if you take any commodity, any input, rather, not money, take any physical input, that's an input into all outputs, directly or indirectly. So it has this character that if you iterate over and over again in an input-output table, you can convert everything to those units. They all predict the relative prices in the market pretty well. It doesn't matter which one you pick. That is, labor does, energy will do it. A steel theory of value does pretty well. They all are pretty similar in terms of their predictions. And that's simply because of the deep interconnectedness of all the things in the economy. And the deviations are the same with respect to all of them. It's where you have monopolies or permanent scarcities. Yeah.
So another argument that Marx made is that labor power is the only commodity that actually reproduces values but generates new values.
No, the same is true for energy. If all the energy in the economy was used to produce energy, we'd have no new value. There has to be, you can talk about the value of energy power, and if all of the use of energy went into producing energy power, we'd have no new value. You have to have surplus energy value in order to have new value. Make the same, that is, you can't use all the energy just to produce energy. You can't use all the labor power just to produce labor power. You have to use labor power beyond that which is needed to reproduce labor power. You have to use energy power beyond that which is needed to produce energy power. So you need surplus energy in order to have value and accumulation, just like you do labor power. Yeah.
Could one argue that labor time is the only input that's necessarily an input to all outputs? In other words, you could get an output with peanuts or with calories, you could get an output without peanuts or without calories, but you can't get an output without labor time. So it's the only one that's necessary.
But energy would do. You can't get an output without energy.
But you could before there was electricity.
No, you have human energy. Measure the kilowatts. Calories burned by a person. Mm-hmm. But as all outputs, this is a physics point. All transformations of nature need energy, human or other. So muscle energy would count as an energy input too.
But is that different from labor time?
Well, in a world where that's the only input, then the two theories are the same. But the energy theory of value would say what's important about the initial condition is that it's energy that's being expended, not that it's human energy. And then we have a more generalized context. I'm not defending an energy theory of value. I'm just saying how you would do it. Once you get technology and non-human energy involved, then we have two kinds of energy, but they both can be abstractly measured by the same, by a common metric. Daniel,
So I get the sense that they all correlate, right? So it's in the end, it's the same thing. You just so the discussion becomes. It's quite futile. I mean, you just pick one of the things, and it doesn't matter. And actually, we want to explain how it's possible that there's a situation in which people work and don't get
absolutely.
So I think it's just this argument. That's
so essentially. You're absolutely right about this. So the question is, why do we want a labor theory of value? Is it because we believe it actually explains profits, or does it explain the antagonisms of interest between workers and capitalists? Now, I think the labor theory of value is a good accounting system for the heuristic purpose. Heuristic means the instrumental purpose of our exposition, of our analysis. It's the right way of measuring the kind of relations between labor and capitalists that are in play in constituting this as a class system for producing things. That's separate from saying whether economic crisis is explained by the falling rate of profit understood in labor theory of value terms. I don't think labor theory of value, at least at this point, is a particularly credible way of understanding the macro dynamics of capitalism, of explaining them. I do think it's a way of accurately mapping and characterizing the exploitative relationship between capital and labor. That is, it's a way of measuring exploitation of labor. That's what it is. The labor theory of value is a measurement device for establishing the exploitation of labor. But that's separate from whether it explains the aggregate rate of profit in a society, or whether it's the most important determinant of the rate of profit, or whether exploitation is the main explanation of profits.
exploitation does contribute to profits. It's a form of conflict around the rate of profit. But you have to, you also have to have a rate of exploitation of energy to have profits. That is, if it were the case that energy was not exploited in this, in an energy theory of value sense, that is, if all energy was used to produce energy, then you would also have a zero rate of profit. The increase in the efficiency with which energy produces energy will increase the rate of aggregate rate of profit in an economy, just as the increase in the efficiency of the production of labor power will increase it. And there's no reason, with respect to that problem, how do we explain the rate of profit? There's no reason to privilege labor time as the measure. With respect to the problem, how do we explain the nature of the conflict between capital and labor and the continual problem of extracting labor effort from non-owners of the means of production under these relations, for that problem, labor time is completely appropriate. There was a question here and then Adam.
So can we say that, for example, the reason why labor is zero value could not be used in a sufficient way, for example, to explain the today's economy is basically because of the assumption that labor zero value is in fact dependent upon the understanding of diminishing returns, decreasing. Because otherwise, I mean, if it fits nicely with that assumption with Marx, for example, explaining if you introduce, let's say, capitalist introduces a new machine or increases, which increases productivity, which increases the surplus value. In that sense, this would, first of all, increase the people, the number of workers being employed. But over time, because of the distribution of this technology, because there's competition, you cannot employ workers to a certain point. So after that, it will not be profitable. So necessarily, there would be unemployment, which would also help kind of exploitation and continuation of the capitalist system. But if we think that that we assume that there's increasing returns to scale, in that case, you can employ more worker and more worker. And you cannot really assume at least a temporary equilibrium, or which will maybe never happen, but there's a tendency to an equilibrium. So which disrupts the continuation of the system in that sense, and crisis tendency. But also, you cannot basically explain today's system, today's economic system in that way.
I'm not sure I would want to say that the reason why the labor theory of value is itself unsatisfactory is increasing returns to scale as such, because I think it's unsatisfactory even apart from that. That is, it's unsatisfactory because we don't have an argument in favor of it. There's no argument for why labor is the only source of value. The alternative view is that value is produced by the combination of all the inputs to production, that for which alternative uses are possible. You know, it's the kind of relative scarcities of that are packaged into production that determine the value of the things you produce. And that under some circumstances, that's dominated by labor. And under other circumstances, it could be dominated by energy. So there's no, or it could be some vector of all the inputs into production. In terms of a theory of value. Now, what you had to say about increasing returns and the nature of competition and the driving down of rates of profit and so on, and the conditions under which that does and doesn't happen, I think those are all good points. I don't think they require, though, anything like the labor theory of value in order to make those points. You actually explained those mechanisms without reference to the labor theory of value. You can make those kinds of arguments just in terms of equilibrium prices and the nature of competition. Whatever might be the underlying source of value that informs those equilibrium prices, as long as you have, you know, whether you have an energy theory of value or a labor theory of value or a there's an Italian economist named Schwafa who has a more complex cost-based theory of value that isn't a labor theory of value. I think they would all be consistent with those particular arguments. It's 2 minutes after 12. We will continue this on Monday. I'll begin with my approach to exploitation, through the contrast between exploitation and oppression, and then briefly go over Romer's perspective on this. And I'll be at the coffee shop at 8:30 on Monday, unless I hear from anybody who wants to come over.